We are getting too close to the money. Dieser Satz stammt aus dem internen E-Mail-Verlauf von führenden Mitarbeitenden von Google. Geschrieben wurde er 2019 von Benedict Gomez. Ben Gomez ist zu diesem Zeitpunkt Senior Vice President Search and Assistant bei Google. Vereinfacht gesagt, also der Verantwortliche für das Team Search, das die Google-Suche optimiert und weiterentwickelt. Genau die Google-Suche, die wohl die Startseite der allermeisten InternetnutzerInnen ist, wenn sie ihren Browser öffnen. 1998 beginnt die Zeit von Google als Tor zum Internet. Aus einem Studienprojekt wird der Inbegriff des digitalen Wandels. Das Googlen, die Wortneuschöpfung für den Zugang zu Wissen und Vernetzung im Internet. Und seit 1999 widmet jener Ben Gomez sich der Google-Suche. Länger also, als es Werbung in Suchmaschinen gibt. Und dieser Mann schreibt 2019 in einer Mail: Wir kommen dem Geld zu nahe. Aber warum? Dass wir diesen Satz überhaupt lesen können, liegt übrigens an einem Gerichtsprozess. Das US-Justizministerium und einige Bundesstaaten verklagen 2020 Google wegen des Verdachts auf unrechtmäßige Monopolbildung. Auf Grundlage eines Gesetzes, das es seit 1890 gibt, dem Sherman Antitrust Act. Im Verlauf des Prozesses werden interne E-Mails zu Beweismitteln und damit öffentlich. Bis heute sind sie abrufbar. Sie erzählen eine Geschichte, die eine etwas absurde Vermutung nahelegen könnte. Die Google-Suche wurde zu gut in den Augen einiger Verantwortlicher bei Google selbst. Zurück ins Jahr 2019. Google hält, wie übrigens heute noch, rund 90% Marktanteil unter den Suchmaschinen. Seit den 90er Jahren wurde die Suche kontinuierlich verbessert. Präzisere Ergebnisse, Autocomplete, Autocorrect. Die Folge? NutzerInnen brauchen immer weniger Suchanfragen, um ans Ziel zu kommen. Sie verbringen immer weniger Zeit mit der Google-Suche selbst. Für uns ein Erfolg. Für das Ausspielen von Anzeigen aber ein Problem. Denn weniger Suchanfragen pro Suche bedeuten weniger ausgespielte Anzeigen. Und weniger Anzeigen bedeuten Jahresziele wackeln. Und die Sorge um Jahresziele hat dann eine Folge. Ein sogenannter Code Yellow. Googles interner Alarmzustand allerhöchster Priorität. Treibende Kraft hinter dem Alarm: Prabhakar Raghavan. Er ist damals Head of Ads, verantwortlich also für das Anzeigengeschäft. Die Erwartung des Ads-Teams an die Google-Suche: Die Suche sollte auch für die Werbenden attraktiv sein. Das wird sie aber immer weniger, wenn die guten Suchergebnisse zu weniger Verweildauer führen. Ben Gomez hat eine andere Sicht auf das Ganze. I'm getting concerned that growth is all we are thinking about, schreibt er an sein Team. Und in einem Mailentwurf, adressiert an Raghavan, wird er noch deutlicher. Ja, schreibt er, es sei möglich, die Suche zu verschlechtern, Autocorrect abzuschwächen, Menschen länger suchen zu lassen, die Verweildauer zu erhöhen. Aber er schreibt in dem Entwurf auch: I'm deeply, deeply uncomfortable with this. And I'd be surprised if the ads team wants this. Die Mail wird wohl nie abgeschickt. Das Spannungsfeld bleibt. Der Code Yellow wird für den Moment vorläufig anders gelöst. Nach 7 Wochen ist der Zustand beendet. Raghavan bedankt sich in einer Mail bei dem Team, mahnt aber an, dass über das Verhältnis zwischen Google-Suche und den Zielen des Ads-Teams noch zu reden sei. Für den Moment ist aber ein Kompromiss gefunden. Die Krise abgewendet, die Qualität der Google-Suche ist gerettet. Oder? Es gibt nicht wenige Stimmen, die sagen, ganz sicher nicht. Der Tech-Journalist Ed Cetrin, dessen Thesen und Artikel oft kontrovers diskutiert wurden, hat diese E-Mails 2024 minutiös nachgezeichnet. The Man Who Killed Google Search findet viel Beachtung damals. Auch bei meinem Gast in dieser Folge.
I've witnessed our collective descent into the Enshittocene. The era in which everything we love online has turned into a giant pile of shit.
Für Cory Doctorow ist dieser Vorgang mehr als eine Anekdote aus dem Silicon Valley. Für ihn ist es der Beispielfall für ein Muster, dem er selbst einen Namen gegeben hat. Enshittification. Die bewusste, schrittweise Verschlechterung von Plattformen. Erst gut zu NutzerInnen, dann gut zu Geschäftskunden. Und am Ende vor allem mit Blick auf die eigene Bilanz. Denn viele mahnen eine Verschlechterung der Google-Suche seit Jahren an. Und für Doctorow ist es, wie er schreibt, the specific process by which Google enshittified its search. Ein weiterer Wendepunkt in seinen Augen, vom alten Internet zum neuen. Übrigens, schon ein gutes Jahr später, nach diesem E-Mail-Verkehr im Juni 2020, ist Ben Gomez nicht mehr Chef der Google-Suche. Er ist seitdem zuständig für den Bereich Learning and Sustainability bei Google. Sein Nachfolger an der Spitze der Suche? Prabhakar Raghavan. Er bleibt auf dem Posten bis 2024 und ist mittlerweile Chief Technologist bei Google. Verlassen wir nun aber diesen Fall und fragen uns, wohin geht das also? Lohnt sich die Nostalgie für dieses alte Internet, das wir laut Cory Doctorow hinter uns gelassen haben? Und wie entkommen wir als NutzerInnen der Logik von Plattformen? Und was ist eigentlich Enshittification? Darum geht es jetzt. Das ist der Republikast. Mein Name ist Jonas Ross und ich spreche in diesem Podcast mit Menschen, die auf den vielen Bühnen, in unzähligen Gesprächen und mit ihrem Wissen und ihrer Meinung auf der Republika die Themen unserer Zeit verhandelt haben. Es geht um die großen Fragen an unser digitales und gesellschaftliches Zusammenleben, was sie mit uns machen, wie wir sie lösen, wie wir uns zusammenfinden können und niemanden aus den Augen verlieren. Wie angekündigt, spreche ich in dieser Folge mit diesem Mann.
Yes, like all the best Americans, I am Canadian.
Cory Doctorow ist Autor, Aktivist und Sonderberater der Electronic Frontier Foundation, kurz EFF. Die gemeinnützige Organisation setzt sich seit Jahrzehnten für Bürgerrechte im digitalen Raum ein. Sie erstreitet vor Gerichten persönliche Rechte, fordert Transparenz von großen Tech-Unternehmen und warnt seit Jahren vor deren zunehmender Monopolisierung. Seit über 20 Jahren ist Cory Teil dieser Arbeit.
And that means that I've had a front row seat for the Internet's enshittification.
Und bei der Republika 2026 war er auf der Bühne.
I spend a lot of my time sad and angry and scared, and I'm sure many of you do as well. But lately, in the past year or so, I have been feeling something else, something strange. Hope.
Und Cory Doctorow schreibt Science-Fiction-Romane, Sachbücher und fast täglich in seinem Blog. Ende 2022 prägt er einen Begriff, der Karriere macht. Enshittification. Cory schreibt, spricht und schimpft über die bewusste Verschlechterung digitaler Plattformen. Ein ausuferndes Phänomen, das er auch in seinem gleichnamigen Buch analysiert. Why Everything Suddenly Got Worse and What to Do About It. Denn er schimpft nicht nur, er hat auch Lösungen.
A new good internet, built on international digital public goods, built on free, open, transparent and auditable software under the control of the people who depend on it.
Warum sich Nostalgie nach dem alten Internet trotz aller Probleme nicht lohnt und wie ein besseres Internet aussehen könnte. Das habe ich ihn gefragt. Cory, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Happy to have you. I heard you say the phrase that I think was coined by John Hodgman, nostalgia is a toxic impulse.
Yeah.
I mean, aren't you yourself a bit nostalgic about the old internet?
No, because I think that nostalgia is a failure to acknowledge what used to be bad. It's a one-sided yearning for the good things without a recollection of what was terrible. as well. And I am, I would say, more of a synthesist, where I would like the good parts of the old good internet, the parts of Web 2.0 that made it good too, and I'd like to make a new good internet. And I think that that synthesis is an internet where there's an enormous amount of technological self-determination, where the people who use the technology get to decide how it's going to work, either because they themselves can modify it or they can ask someone else or pay someone else to modify it for them, and where it's easy to use. So that normies can use it. And I think that the tech bosses would like you to think that that's impossible. They're practicing what I call vulgar Thatcherism. You know, Margaret Thatcher used to say, there is no alternative. She said it so often, they called her Tina, there is no alternative. And what she meant was stop trying to think of an alternative, right? Don't you dare try to imagine an alternative. And this is what Mark Zuckerberg would like you to do. He would like you to think that if you want to talk to your friends, he has to be able to listen in. And that asking for a way to talk to your friends without Mark Zuckerberg in the group chat is like asking for water that's not wet. I mean, it sounds like a nice idea, but let's be realistic here, right? Let's be reasonable. And I think it's reasonable to say, I'd like a phone that works reliably where Tim Cook doesn't get to decide which apps I use. And I'd like to have a search engine that works reliably without Google getting to know everything about me.
Yeah.
And I think that this is absolutely possible to build. In fact, I know it's possible to build because Apple built great computers before they asserted the right to control your software. Facebook didn't spy on you when they launched, and Google didn't do surveillance when they started their search engine. So it's absolutely possible to do this.
But there is a kind of nostalgia because you said it was this way and then it got worse. So
well, but I don't pretend that the parts that were bad were good.
I like that. Yeah.
You know, just because there were defects in the old internet, it doesn't mean that that its positive aspects didn't exist. And then by the same token, the kind of Web 2.0 ease of use revolution that did get all of my cool friends who were just not technical enough to use the internet online and meant that we could have a party that included everyone I wanted to invite and not just the people who were, you know, interested in doing all those very technical things. That was good too. And I want both of those things. I want the good parts of both of those things. There is an alternative.
Okay. Before we dive into how we might get back this alternative, let's dive into what you have possibly explained a million times, I'd say, entrification. So
sure.
I think there's a part of it is something that people that are less techie, like myself, have been feeling. Like you use the internet and you have this feeling of something has been changing, something has changed.
Yeah.
And it's more a feeling than a fact. You can't really make out what it is. But for me, when I stumbled upon entitification, the phrase you coined, I kind of got an answer. So what is entitification?
Well, for 25 years, I worked for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which is, I think, the world's most important and effective digital rights group. I was their European director for some years as well. And I, in the course of that work, have spent most of my adult life trying to get people to engage with issues about technology policy. And the thing is that tech policy is very abstract, and it usually relates to things that are far in the future. And for good reasons, people mostly care about things that are concrete and happening right now. But the problem is that by the time tech issues are concrete and happening right now, it's too late. And so you really want people to increase the salience of these abstract, technical, far future questions. And so I've come up with all kinds of metaphors and framing devices and parables. And because I'm a science fiction writer, a lot of narratives. But it turned out that the dirty word was the secret to unlocking people's interest in it. I think partly because it is so frustrating that it allows you to, on the one hand, name and invoke the analysis, but on the other hand, to express your kind of atavistic frustration with what's going on. So what is enchidification beyond a way to engage people with these technical questions? It is a description of how platforms go bad and a theory about why. And the description is that you have this three-stage process. In stage one, platforms are good to their end users, but they find a way to lock them in. In stage two, because they know those users can't readily leave, they make things worse for them in order to make things better for businesses. And then they make things bad for businesses once they're locked in stage three, and they take all the value for themselves. And they leave behind the minimum value needed to keep users on the platform and businesses on the users. But the why of it is really the answer to why your dog licks its balls. Because they can. Because we don't stop them. It's not because you as a consumer failed to choose wisely. It's not because if you're not paying for the product, you're the product. I don't care if you're paying for the product or not. If the company can get away with treating you as the product, they absolutely will. We see that time and again, whether it's Apple or John Deere or Mercedes. It's not because the people who run these companies are horrible, although they often are, but those horrible people had better products before. And if they were to, you know, overdose on ketamine tonight, there'd be a succession battle of 12 horrible big balls, and whoever steps in to fill Elon Musk's shoes tomorrow would be indistinguishable from him,
yeah,
because he's filling a niche, and that niche was created by our policymakers, who created the enshittogenic policy environment where the worst ideas of the worst people make the most money, because we stopped enforcing competition laws, which let these companies capture their regulators. It let them brief for IP laws that make it illegal for new competitors to enter the market, and let them capture their workforce as well. And without a strong workforce, without competitors, without regulators, and without new market entry from firms that spring into existence to disenshittify the things they wreck, then these companies make more money by being horrible. And then they are.
Yeah. Now, these three phases, I mean, it starts in with being locked in, and that locking in is kind of the key to everything.
Sure.
I heard you compare using the internet should be like using your phone provider. Like, you don't need, you're not fixed on the one. You don't care if you talk on Telecom or you talk on Vodafone, or it doesn't matter. You just talk to your friends. But these platforms basically have created an environment where you think you to communicate with other people, you need those platforms.
Yeah.
Is that the idea of locking people in?
Yeah, there are a lot of different ways that firms practice lock-in. You know, if you're Apple, you just have an environment where it's illegal to install software, thanks to the copyright directive. It's illegal to install software without Apple's permission. And so then Apple can use software locks to stop you from taking it to an independent repair shop for some repairs, from using third-party parts, from using third-party apps. And so the more you spend on your iPhone and its accessories and its software and its cloud, the harder it is for you to switch, right? Mm-hmm. That's Apple's technique. Google did something different. They bought all the shelf space where you might find another search engine, and thus induced a lost generation of investment in search. So Apple gets a bribe from Google every year, $20 billion, not to enter the search market, so that they can divide up the market. It's like the Pope dividing up the new world. And by not having to engage in what Peter Thiel calls wasteful competition, they can each avoid eroding the other one's wages, right? Like, they've demarcated their territory. And so it doesn't matter what operating system you use or what carrier you have or what browser you use, you're always going to be searching Google. So who's going to invest a lot of money in a rival search engine? You have Ecosia, you have a few others around the margins. But you look at Google, it's a company that's valued in the trillions of dollars. You would expect, and they have gigantic margins, double-digit margins growing every year, right? You would expect that a firm worth trillions of dollars and double-digit margins growing every year would attract a competitor. But if you've bought all the shelf space and no one is ever going to find the competitor's product, what investor is going to capitalize that? So, you know, weirdly, the best Google competitor I know, and this is not a paid endorsement or anything, I just use them because I like them, is a company called Kagi, K-A-G-I. And I started using them because my editor recommended them. And he's the sort of most smartest kind of self-educated polymath I know. And he was like, are you still using Google? You should be using Kagi. And I was like, what is that? And he said, do you remember the first time you used Google instead of Alta Vista? And you were like, this is magic. That's what it feels like to use Kagi. So I started using Kagi. It's $10 a month. And I was using it, very happy with it. And then I read an article by Jason Kebler from 404 Media. It's a great tech reporter, where he was talking about Kagi. What he revealed is that Kagi is a front end to Google. They pay Google for access to Google's index, which is funny because I don't know how many people work at Kagi. I think it's a couple of dozen. But a couple of dozen people working at a small capitalized search engine can produce better Google results than Google can, which tells you that Google is choosing to make it worse because they have you locked in. They know you're not going to go anywhere.
Yeah.
There used to be these funny fake ads for the AT&T that Lily Tomlin would do on Saturday Night Live. She would pretend to be an AT&T operator. And they would always end with her turning to the camera and saying, we don't care. We don't have to. We're the phone company, right? When you have a 90% search market share and you have bought all the shelf space, you don't care. You don't have to. You're the search company. So that's another way of doing lock-in. Amazon, you know, they use what's called predatory pricing, where you sell goods below cost in order to force competitors out of the market, as well as this other form of lock-in, which is prime, which is getting you to prepay for a year's worth of shipping in advance in order to sew up the market. They drove most of their competitors out of business, and then they got the majority of affluent households to buy in. Social media, it's different. Social media, it's like really easy. You don't have to do these high-stakes, multi-billion-dollar efforts, because we do it ourselves through something that economists call the collective action problem, which is just a way of saying you love your friends, but they're a pain in the ass, right? You're not, you can't agree on what board game you're going to play this weekend. And so how are you going to agree on when it's time to leave Facebook? And you love your friends more than you hate Mark Zuckerberg, and he knows it. So long as he makes sure that he doesn't make you hate him more than you love your friends, you'll stay there. And so that's like, that's kind of the fiscal space that he operates in. He has that much flexibility to worsen your life in ways that benefit him, provided he doesn't overstep, provided he finds that equilibrium between how much you hate him and how much you love your friends. Mm. And so that lock-in, you know, we say, oh, it's a free choice. You can just go if you want to. People throughout history have been locked in by the love of the people around them. You know, my family were Soviet refugees. And my grandmother, she came to Canada after the war. She had been a child soldier in the Siege of Leningrad. And then when she was 15, after 3 years, she was evacuated over the winter ice. She was inducted into the Red Army, met my grandfather in Siberia. He got her pregnant. They deserted. They went to Azerbaijan. My dad was born. The war ended. And they basically walked to Frankfurt. And they got on a displaced persons boat to Canada. None of the rest of the family did that. Something about being separated from her family ruptured my grandmother's relationship to them. But all the ones who stayed behind were holding each other hostage because they knew they couldn't all make it. But none of them could go because the other ones were depending on them. And their lives are so much worse than the lives of the family that went to Canada. You know, we get on these crazy Zoom calls with them, and all the young men are worried about being inducted into the army. They're materially much poorer than us. They didn't have the opportunities we had. They couldn't travel freely. Everything was worse about their lives. They could foresee that in 1945, but they stayed. You know, there are a lot of people who could have made it over the wall who stayed in East Berlin, because going to Kreuzberg, or from Kreuzberg to the Kudamm, was not a matter of getting on the U-Bahn. You make it as easy as getting on the U-Bahn, people go back and forth all the time. But to say, oh, well, you didn't go, so you preferred life in the DDR, well, it's the kind of thing that you can only say if you have the specific brain injury that you get from doing an economics degree. So economists, they have this idea of revealed preferences. And revealed preferences is the idea that even if you say you don't like something, if you still do it, you must really like it. And this is a thing you can only believe if you can neither perceive nor reason about power, right? If you believe in revealed preferences, you'll see someone who sells their kidney to pay the rent. And you go, look at that person with a revealed preference for one kidney, right? It's not until you give people real choices that you find out what they want. And the social media bosses, just like the people who ran the DDR, they know that the thing that keeps you in isn't just the wall. It's your bonds of solidarity with the people around you.
Yeah, it's a very powerful image, I have to say. And I mean, you wrote that you will not shop your way from away from a monopoly.
Sure.
And, so, I mean, of course, these systems that are not created by the user, you say. So the problem in this case is not in front of the screen. And you also say that it's not the fault inherently by the people on top of these companies, because you say the problem basically is in the policy.
Yeah.
So that sounds to me that the policy itself is determined to make the internet be enshitted, if you like.
Yeah.
Would you say that's true?
Yeah, and it's frustrating because, you know, the policymakers who took these decisions, they took them not in a vacuum where no one said, hey, if you stop enforcing competition law, you'll get monopolies. Lots of people said, stop enforcing competition law and you will get monopolies. And they were like, I don't think that's true. Right. And, you know, having been warned that this would happen and then having done it anyway, and then having had it happen, they still insist that they did nothing wrong. You know, a lot of these economists, they're still around. They're polishing their fake Nobel Prizes in economics. It's not a real Nobel Prize. Economists were like, no one takes us seriously. We should get someone called Nobel to give us a prize. That is literally true. So they polished their fake Nobel Prizes. They take six-figure consulting fees for these big blue-chip companies that want to do anti-competitive mergers. And when we say you are to blame for the monopolies in every sector, from mattresses to glass bottles to vitamin C, they say, why would you blame us, right? What connection could our pro-monopoly policies possibly have with the rise of monopolies? That's nuts. It's like we used to not have a rat problem because we all used rat poison. And then they said, why are you using rat poison? Get rid of it. And now rats are eating our faces off. And when we get angry at them about it, they're like, I think you'll find that we are simply living through the time of the rat. You know, this is the great forces of history and the iron laws of economics making rats fecund. It's not my pro-rat policies. I mean, sure, the rats did buy the rat poison factories and shut them down, but look, we're not using rat poison anymore. That's just economically rational conduct. It's Pareto optimal. And so, you know, this policy and many like it had but not just the foreseeable outcome of producing the enshittocene, the era in which everything turns to shit, but also it was a foreseen outcome, an outcome that was explicitly briefed to our policymakers who went ahead and did it anyway. And while that's very frustrating, it's also somewhat hopeful because it means that if we can get different policymakers and or different policies, then we could have a different internet. Yeah. That if it's not the great forces of history, but specific policies, then we can have different ones.
Yeah. Do you think that's something that only applies to the US? Because in a way, and I've had talks on this podcast where I learned that the knowledge of the system or behind the internet and the mechanics of the internet are not really that known to politicians in a way. So they don't really know why things are the way they are. So people have to basically explain to them how the internet works. And then, and I think especially on this European level where these huge laws are made, which of course take time, it's also a problem of not understanding how the mechanics of it are. So do you think this is like a US problem imported into...
No, not real. So first of all, I reject that framing. I think that you don't have to understand technical questions to make good politics about technical questions. There aren't any water chemists, as far as I know, in the German federal government. And yet you can still drink the water, right? And the reason for that, and you know, waterborne illnesses have killed more people than anything else in the history of the world, right? And the reason for that is that you have expert agencies that gather data from firms, individuals, scholars, researchers, and then they act as neutral arbiters of that truth-seeking exercise to figure out what the policy should be. And they conduct it in public. They recuse themselves if they have conflicts of interest. And there's a process for reopening any of those settled questions in light of new evidence. And that's what good policy looks like. That's not how we do tech policy. And in part, we don't do tech policy that way because we allow tech companies to buy each other. And when you have 200 companies in a sector and you ask, should we do X, Y, or Z? Some of the companies benefit from doing X, some benefit from doing Y, and some benefit from doing Z. And they all show up to call bullshit on each other. If you say, should we change the rules about the alloys that can be used in structural joists that are keeping the ceiling above our head from killing us right now? And there are firms that have alloys that are quite... cheap that they have a patent for or that they're better than making, and they show up and they say our material can be substituted in and it'll be cheaper and outcompete all the rest. Another firm that competes with them will say, I believe that that is unsafe and here's my reasoning, right? And what the regulator does is they intervene to figure out whether or not one person is lying or the other, and they try and strike the best evidence-based policy. But when there's five firms in the sector, or four or three or two or one, they all show up and they tell the same lie because they all have the same business model, right? When there's like five telecoms companies in your country and you say, should we have net neutrality? They all show up and say no. And what there isn't is another company of similar size that shows up and says, not only is net neutrality possible, but we do it. And here's our network logs and here's our cash books and here's our customer satisfaction surveys. And all these guys are lying, right? The only people who get to show up and say that under conditions of monopoly or cartel are people who run tiny little ISPs. And what you get are the giant carriers who say, Let them come back when they've got 20 million customers. And mm-hmm. then we can find out whether or not they know anything about running a real carrier, right? And so it's just very hard to make good policy in the face of monopolies. I think we let them off too easy when we say, oh, you're old and clueless and you don't know how this works. We would never do that if they were like, I am too old to learn structural engineering. From now on, we can build the bridges out of potatoes, right? We would expect them to be smarter, not by going back to engineering school, but by running a good policy shop. And we should expect nothing less about our internet policy.
Yeah. There's this rising problem that there's this entanglement of these cartels, of these big uh-huh. firms with the government.
Yeah.
So they made themselves basically, they can't be deployed. Yeah. They can't be separated from the government system. So, I mean, that makes policymaking a bit harder.
Much harder.
Centered around the user.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's a joke from Eastern Canada, from Newfoundland, whose punchline is, if you wanted to get there, I wouldn't start from here. and I think, you know, we can trace back to the moment where that moment began where firms became large and structurally important to states. And it's the ordo-liberal turn. It's Helmut Kohl, Margaret Thatcher, Brian Mulroney, Ronald Reagan, Augusto Pinochet. And it's this economic belief in the efficiency of monopolies. So it's useful to take a look at the history of anti-monopoly law, both in the U.S. and in Europe. So in the U.S., the first anti-monopoly law was passed in 1890 by a senator called John Sherman, whose biggest claim to fame, apart from writing this law, is that his brother was Tecumseh Sherman, the Civil War general who burned down Atlanta. And John Sherman, when he was creating the Sherman Act, the first anti-monopoly law, he said, if we would not tolerate a king in America, we should not tolerate an autocrat of trade with the power to control the necessaries of life. So it was never about efficiency. He was never like, we need to keep these companies lean and mean and thinking about their user. He was like, we need to make them democratically accountable.
Yeah.
Because if they're bigger than states, then there is no democratic accountability for them. And all the mechanisms that we hope to use to discipline companies, whether that's their workers or regulation or competition, all of those go out the window if we let the firms get too big. And after World War II, American technocrats came to Europe to rebuild the European system. So both the cities and the laws. It was called the Marshall Plan. And one of the things that they observed is that monopolies in the Axis powers were incredibly important to the rise of fascism. They said that when you have firms that are so large that they can control political outcomes, you get politicians and companies that merge into these authoritarian systems that treat humans as kind of raw fodder, whether that's slave labor or, as undesirables to be eliminated or what have you, right? And that this was a foundational requirement for the rise of fascism was monopoly. And so they transposed, in the Marshall Law, they transposed American antitrust law onto Europe's law books.
Yeah.
As of about 1950, West Germany's antitrust laws, England's antitrust laws, France's antitrust laws, South Korea and Japan's antitrust laws, Italy, Spain's, they're all basically American antitrust law. And that was the way that both countries operated, both territories, the U.S. and the countries in its sphere of influence during the Cold War and after World War II. That was the way that they all operated, was on the basis that you could not allow firms to get too large or it would threaten your democracy, which is why I always go back to this moment in the 80s where they said we should allow firms to have monopolies because monopolies are efficient. Not only is that not true, that when firms get too big to fail, they get too big to care, but also, even if it was true, it wouldn't be enough because it's not enough for firms to be efficient. They also have to be safe to live among. They have to be made safe for human cohabitation. You know, a company is a transhuman colony organism that uses human beings as gut flora. They're alien invaders.
Yeah.
And if we let them get too powerful, they conquer us.
Yeah. But I mean, I heard you say that the internet itself was never determined to be democratic because people think that like the internet itself is such a democratic idea.
Uh-huh.
And I heard you say that it's not like automatically democratic just because it exists the way it is. So in a way, if the internet is not automatically democratic and these firms are not automatically democratic, there is a huge gap between what we want to happen and how we want it to work and how we want the system to work and the reality.
Yeah.
So how do we bridge the gap? How do we get this power back? How do we make it user-centric?
So in the old good internet, it was user-centric because most of the people who used the internet were technical.
Yeah.
And there were very few technical barriers to modifying the internet. If you didn't like how it worked, you changed it. So everyone had the capacity and the right to alter how the technology that they used worked, which meant that anytime someone else tried to do something adverse to your interests, or you disagreed about how to do things, or you had an idea that no one else had thought of, you could just make it happen. And, you know, we have some amazing examples of this, right? There was a physics researcher in Switzerland at CERN who was supposed to be working on physics and instead was playing with the internet, and he made a thing called the World Wide Web, right? And he just made it. He didn't get someone at Deutsche Telekom to provision it, or AT&T or British Telecoms. He just made it, right? And he didn't like the way it worked, and he changed it. And then he made it open, which meant that anyone who didn't like the way that he made it work could change it. And we got what we have, what we had in the most glorious days of the internet, a time when there was an enormous amount of user centrism, in the sense that the users that were there at the time were able to change the things that they used and make them work for themselves. We could have that again. We could have it maybe not with every user learning how to change all the technology. There's a kind of person who likes doing that. Although I think it's larger than the pool of people who self-identify as technologists. Mm. That there's some of the most technologically adventurous people I know are people who are constrained, not people who are technically curious, right? Like the first person I ever met who had a phone that had two SIMs in it were the ladies who worked at the nursery that my daughter went to in East London and who made minimum wage.
Yeah.
And they knew that there was one carrier that gave them unlimited calls and another one that gave them unlimited texts to their seven best friends. And they figured out how to use a SIM and change their phone's operating system, two SIMs, and change their phone's operating system to support those two SIMs so they could do it, because it was just important to them. There are lots of people who are willing to figure out esoteric technical questions when it matters to them. And if we create the space for it, they'll do it. So what stands in the way of doing it? Well, the biggest impediment in Europe right now is two. One is that we can't get the companies to do what we ask them to do or tell them to do because they're so big that they can ignore the government. It's kind of too late to do something about that. Or at least we need to come up, we need to solve that problem before we can get them to do anything else. We forgot John Sherman's law. We allowed the autocrats of trade. And if you wanted to start, if you wanted to get there, I wouldn't start from here. But there's another big impediment, which is that in 2001, Europe enacted the Copyright Directive. Mm-hmm. Article 6 of the Copyright Directive makes it a crime to modify technology without permission.
Yeah.
And almost the only beneficiaries of this are American companies, which raises this question: why did Europe pass a law that makes it illegal for European companies to fix the shitified defective products that America exports to Europe?
And it basically resembles the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, I'd say, from
just
America.
Like the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. Yeah, the America's law. And the answer is that the U.S. Trade Representative told Europe and every other major trading partner, or every trading partner of the U.S., that unless you have a law like this, you will have tariffs on your exports. So Comrade Trump has saved the day, right? He has finally broken the logjam that I've tried to break for 25 years. People were like, well, we can't afford to have tariffs on our exports. Well, now you have them.
Yeah.
And you don't just have fixed tariffs. You have a different tariff every day depending on what kind of mood Trump is in.
Yeah.
So, you know, you manufacture goods now. You put them on a shipping container in 6 months. Maybe today the tariff is 10%. Maybe it's 10 million percent in six months. So you can't count on the American market.
Yeah.
If you can have it, it's a nice to have. But you shouldn't base your business plans on it. So he has made this case that we should change the law. And he hasn't just made it by hitting us with tariffs. He's also made this case by showing us how closely aligned those American tech firms are to his regime, as Slobodian was saying, where you have, judges like the high court justice in Brazil who sentenced Jair Bolsonaro to prison for attempting to steal the government after he lost the election, Bolsonaro, you know, was a dictator who's Trump's ally. Trump got really angry and Microsoft shut down the court.
Yeah.
They lost all of their accounts. They can't even use their non-Microsoft accounts because their accounts are tied to their Microsoft, their Outlook addresses. Yeah. He did the same thing to the Chief Justice of the International Criminal Court when he swore out an arrest warrant for the genocidaire Benjamin Netanyahu, another ally of Trump. And I think a lot of people who don't really care about industrial policy and don't really care about human rights, but do care about national security are going, well, wait. If he wants to steal Greenland, he doesn't have to roll tanks. He can just shut off Greenland. He can brick Greenland. He could steal the country, right, by shutting off its IT. It'd be like Straits of Hormuz, but for, you know, licorice and Ozempic and Lego. And that means that we have to get the fuck off of the American internet.
Yeah.
And the only way we're going to do that is if we can repeal Article 6 of the Copyright Directive, jailbreak those American silos and extract our data from them and put them in sovereign technology. It's not enough to build the sovereign technology. And there are lots of people here very excited, rightly so, about Eurostack and the idea that we're going to build servers and then write digital international public goods that run on those servers that replicate the functionality of American tech products without their defects, that are autonomous, sovereign, controlled by people in the country who use them. That's great, but unless there's a way to get the data off of Office 365 and into the Eurostack, this is like building housing for people who live in East Berlin, but you're building it in West Berlin, right? It doesn't matter how good the housing is. No one's going to risk getting shot in the back to move into their new housing.
So digital sovereignty is always tied to a post-American internet, which means you kind of have to path the way back to cooperation instead of like this dependency and open up the market for alternatives. But I mean, you and the EFF kind of try to work on, let's say, giving back the power of the internet to the people.
Yeah.
So how do you work on a post-American internet?
Well, if one country, it doesn't have to be Europe, if any country decides to repeal Article 6 of the Copyright Directive or their equivalent to it, could be Canada, could be Mexico, Ghana, Nigeria, Malaysia has just announced that they're not going to honor any of their trade obligations to the U.S. because the U.S. isn't honoring any of their trade obligations to them. Every pro quo needs a quid. That country can export the tools to everyone else.
Yeah.
Right? You know, in Canada, we export a lot of reasonably priced pharmaceuticals to Americans whose pharma companies are allowed to charge them ghastly sums of money for things like insulin. Well, if Americans can figure out how to buy insulin through the U.S. mail from Canada, then they can figure out how to buy software over the internet from anywhere. And so can we here in Europe, so can Canadians, so can people everywhere in the world. Some country steps in and is the disincentivization nation. They get to have the relationship to the tools that make your technology better that, say, Finland had to the world of mobile telephony in the decade when Nokia reigned supreme. They get to consume the accumulated rents of the American tech giants, the trillions of dollars they've stolen from the rest of the world, and use it as fuel for a single-use rocket that boosts their tech sector into a stable orbit for generations. And we and the rest of the world just don't get robbed, which is great. It's nice for us as consumers. We don't get the tech sector. That we'll end up getting our technology from someone else. But they'll be international digital public goods, which means they won't be able to enclose them and use them to exploit us. If they make things worse, then we'll just fix them.
Yeah. Unfortunately, our time is almost off, but yep. I wanted to ask you one thing because you, of course, are a science fiction writer as well, mm-hmm. and have written a lot of stories. And I was wondering how much of your own work of other works of science fiction do you see resembled in the present?
So science fiction is never really about the future, right? No one can predict the future, which is good. If we could predict the future, there'd be no reason to get out of bed, right? We make the future. It's so fatalistic to believe in fortune telling. There are some science fiction writers who think that they're fortune tellers. Those people are very sad. What I think science fiction does is it predicts the present. It is a way of using futuristic parables to reflect on the possibilities, the fears, and the aspirations that we have for technology today. And by illuminating facts about the present, you are affecting the future. You know, the present is the standing wave where the past is becoming the future. It's the membrane through which time passes to make the future. And so if you can make people understand risks, if you can make people understand possibilities, then you might inspire them to live their lives and work in concert to make a better future or avoid a worse one. But that's very different from predicting. It's much better.
I love that. Cory, thank you so much for your time.
Well,
and
my pleasure.
Thank you for being on the show.
Thank you.
Das war eine neue Folge des Republikas. Mein Name ist Jonas Ross und ich habe auch in der vierten Staffel dieses Podcasts mit vielen Menschen gesprochen auf der Republika 2026. Abonniert den Podcast, um auch die anderen Gespräche nicht zu verpassen. Und wenn der Podcast euch gefällt, dann lasst auf jeden Fall eine Bewertung da. Das hilft immer. Vielen Dank fürs Zuhören und bis zum nächsten Mal. Alles Gute.